Johnny, I have a great show for you today. I'm very excited. Stephen Grisham Barber is here. But before we get to that, I want to talk to you about some stuff. First of all, I am Johnny. I'm the host of this podcast. Thank you for listening to it. I know that you have to go out and find it and sit down and actually listen to it. That's not lost on me. Thank you so much for doing that. I really appreciate it. And while I'm on the subject of that, I'm kind of in this weird position right now. I'm meeting with some people this week. I want to talk to them about branching out into a network. And I'm not sure. I know that there's going to be benefits to being on a network. Maybe getting out to some new people, different audiences. Maybe someone else will handle some of the work that I don't want to do. I don't know yet. You know, we're going to talk about this, but I wanted to talk to you about it. I don't know where to go with this. I just thought it was just kind of growing. And, you know, the thought of it kind of taking another step is something that I want, but I want it to be the right step. You know, I know that whoever I go to work with, I'll go with them because they don't want to change the show at all. I just want to make sure that it's promoted the right way through the right channels. That it still maintains its, I don't know what I'm doing. But I'm 157 episodes in, and I don't want to stop doing it. And I certainly don't really make any money doing it. And I do want to, but I wonder if that's going to change the dynamic or how I feel about it or what. How do I get guests? You know, I don't know. I'm confused. So basically, this is why I'm coming to you guys. There's nothing funny about that, about that intro. Sorry. I just wanted to bounce it off you guys. What do you think? What would you like to see happen with the show? Because to me, at this point, it's kind of almost as much yours as it is mine. We all listen to it, or I do it. You guys listen to it. We're kind of in this together. You know, tweet at me, at Johnny Gowdy, or go to the Facebook page and say, hey, this is what we'd like to see happen. You know, the people that I'm talking to are all good people. People that I would want to be affiliated with. People that I know. People that I like. So that isn't a question. It's just a matter of, do I want to keep on owning this thing and take it, let it grow organically and let it be this thing? Or do I want to take this big step right now, move into another thing, and I don't really know what'll happen with it. I do know that I love doing it, though, and I want to keep on doing it, and I want it to be super fun, and I want to keep on getting bigger guests and great conversations. So I'm going to keep on doing that no matter who I'm affiliated with. If I stay solo, if I go and affiliate myself with another network or this show with another network. But I guess you'll be knowing. I'll keep you updated on what's going on, and we'll do that. Otherwise, I had a great weekend. Hung out with my friend Jazz Mills. I went and saw my friend Lucas Melendez do some comedy at a big show. And another guy, Danny Palumbo, who's very funny. And it looks like Lucas and I think Matt Bearden, we're going to do a thing together this week. And so you'll be hearing that. So stay tuned. Always good conversations coming your way on How Did I Get Here? Let's get down.
How did I get here? Lying in the sunshine.
My guest today is the phenomenally talented composer, arranger, and musician Stephen Grisham Barber. I've known Stephen for over a decade at this point. I get to hang out with him every once in a while at dinners. I run into him at this French place called Justine sometimes. We end up talking. He's a really nice guy, really amazingly rich life, and a very, very caring, soulful, cool cat who has done so much big work. I mean, he's worked with David Byrne, Keith Richards, Ornette Coleman, Jennifer Warnes, Gilberto Gil, Chris Whitley, Eric Johnson, Natalie Merchant, Los Lonely Boys. I mean, tons and tons of people. He was in the band Electromagnetics in the 70s with Eric Johnson, kind of the band that made his thing happen. He played on that first Eric Johnson record that came out, Tones. He's been a part of a lot of different music and a lot of soundtracks. He scored a lot of stuff. He scored art pieces. He scored I think, dances and stuff. The guy's just phenomenal. And he's a great, beautiful person with a fantastic story. He's done classical music. He's done jazz music. He's done rock and roll. He's done world music. He's just all around like a piece of gold. I just love him. Here's my conversation with the amazing Stephen Grisham Barber.
Working with Carl Thiel. We're working on a project. Carl and I have worked on a number of things, and he's just an amazing. He's just, everything has so much ease in that studio. And yeah. We're working on a film by a director by the name of Steven Zeifman, who he does primarily the exclusive print work and book work for the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Among other things. But amazing, amazing guy, amazing artist. And
what are you guys working on? And what kind of film is it?
It is a film on Stieglitz Gallery in the early in the turn of the century, called the 291 Gallery, that was located at 291 Fifth Avenue, around 30th and 5th. And
right.
And this was a time when art was changing, and now, you know, it was essentially Paris moving into New York before New York was really an art capital, and where African art was now, it never really made its presentation, you know, until that time, and where African art was now a major, an exclusive piece of art, you know, in that lived in the high ether. Among Picasso and Matisse and
who are those guys? Because you don't really know them by name like you do a Picasso or Matisse.
Yeah, I mean,
you know?
Yeah.
And that was at the turn of the century?
Yeah, turn of the century. And African art came into the whole scene. And also, you know, photography, of course, that Stieglitz was into. And this story
right.
is about Georgia O'Keeffe's first visit to New York when Stieglitz took her art and put it in with Picasso and Cezanne and all these amazing artist from Paris, and she was the only American artist that was curated in that gallery, and he misspelled her name, called her Virginia O'Keeffe. And of course, she went up there indignant, wanting to go kick his ass, and you know, obviously, with a misspelled name on top of it, and the rest is history. They fell in love, you know, and had a relationship for over 50 years. But it's her kind of maiden voyage to New York, and it's a film short, about 12 minutes long, but it's fun.
Wow. So do you do a lot of film work?
I enjoy film, especially documentary work.
Yeah.
I like a lot. And I worked for the BBC for a while, did a few films for them in like the 90s and for the Natural History Unit in Bristol.
Oh, really?
You know, they come over here like National Geo and PBS Nova and stuff like that. But I love it. Yeah.
Have you scored like actual film, movie films?
Yeah, I made a lot of. Yeah, I did a couple of films for Canon a long time back, and just kind of, I don't know, it was a good way of, I just like documentary style working. It kind of defined what I really enjoyed working on. But yeah, I've done for Divine Secrets of Yaya Sisterhood. I've arranged sequences, small uh-huh. sequences, and I did one little sequence in that movie and in others too.
When you're doing something like that, did you get asked by like the producers?
I got asked by T-Bone Burnett.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Are you friends with him?
Yeah, certainly. I've known T-Bone a long time. I've worked on some projects with him. Amazing guy.
I had someone else in here, I can't remember who it was, that worked with him that said it was fantastic.
He knows how
to. The Zen master.
He does. I mean, in that particular thing, we were working on a project with in Divine Secrets, we had the, a small orchestra there, And, you know, we were kind of, it was a Richard Thompson tune called Dimming of the Day.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a little bit of lull in the frequency, and T-Bone walked in and explained to the musicians what was going on in the queue and what we had hoped to find successful with that queue. And they, through a very, very elegant and well-spoken little snippet, he gave them what we needed to do, and bang, the whole air ionized, and we got a completely different kind of performance and rendering. So he knows exactly where to put that, you know, where to find the bullseye and get it moving. So
on a session like that, what are you doing? Are you conducting? Are you playing? Are you, what are you doing?
But generally, most session players hate conductors, but I kind of wave my arms around as little as possible. And it was very tricky, that track, because we had no click track on the Richard Thompson tune. And as a result, he completely T-Bone wiped out the entire playing track, the audio track, leaving only the vocals there.
Wow.
And I had to score it to the vocals. So it was a little tricky, but we made it happen.
And that was Divine Secrets of Yaya Said, was that before like a Pro Tools and all that stuff was in there?
They had had Pro Tools, and we kind of simulated somewhat of a loose click, but...
But you didn't cut and paste and move shit around, because it was one flowing piece.
Yeah, it was one flowing vocal off the track, off the tape.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was no way to move that around. The vocal was already in stone. So there are all kinds of tricky configurations coming down the pike. But I personally, you know, am not a giant click kind of guy. But I believe in just kind of pushing the air around. And it's made pretty good music in the past. So.
Yeah, it really has.
Like a band called the Beatles and James Brown and... John Lee Hooker and some of those folks.
And you know what? I know that you probably like these bands, but they don't have a future.
No. It's a fad.
Right, yeah, it's totally a fad. So what about on this Carl Thiel session? Were you playing, conducting? Did you have a group in there?
Well, generally what we've worked in the past is rendering an orchestra, and he has some amazing samples, and he also can control them to get a very organic sound. And then I generally come in live players to do solos.
Oh, okay.
For instance, I'll use Lee Mahoney from the Tosca Girls and Sarah and various members of Tosca, and sometimes the entire section, to come in and put some bows and John Mills I use on winds, clarinets, and flutes and saxes. So,
how many instruments do you play?
I play a lot, very very badly.
You do?
I play piano and guitar decently, and then studying the instruments, you have to kind of learn the fingerings and get around on them and in the past. So, I mean, I have played wind instruments, but there's one story when I was learning how to play alto saxophone in my apartment in New York, and there was a person living to me with a master's in music and came up to me the next morning and said, "What instrument are you playing?" So I was kind of intimidated. So I did most of my practicing in the closet, kind of buried clothes. Yeah.
So what was the very first instrument? Because it says here that when you picked up your first instrument at the age of three, you knew that music was your calling.
Yeah.
And so what was that instrument?
It was piano, and then violin, and then ukulele were my first. And piano was the one that really felt a very organic way of making music. And when I had a violin up there, I remember being very young and feeling a little bit out of sorts and a little bit discomforting when they finally put me in position of how to play. So that was quickly evacuated, probably for a good reason, but it's a real difficult instrument to play. And I don't know. And then guitar came, and then through guitar and drums and in bands, you kind of learn how to play drums. You learn how to play bass.
Right.
You learn how to filling in the gaps when no one was there. And
so when were your parents, were they music people?
My mom was, came from a pretty serious musical family and literature, the Grisham family, and my mom's a
you mean Grisham, like really?
John Grisham was my cousin, yeah.
Wow.
And Carol Hall, who wrote The Best Little Whorehouse of Texas, the music to that, she's a Grisham as well.
Really?
And I had uncles and
cousins. She wrote Texas has a whorehouse in it. Really?
Yes. Yes.
That's fucking awesome. Yeah, that is awesome.
Yeah, it's my cousin Carol. She's an amazing writer, and she's written for Bill Evans and, I mean, so many brilliant people.
And so you came from like an art family, and you guys, West Texas? What city?
Abilene, Texas, and we were in Abilene, and then we were either in Abilene or New York, so that's where we all went. And
wow.
And had cousins in, you know, Carlo Renzulli, who was in the New York Philharmonic, and Josephine, Carol's mother, was a violinist, and it was all...
Well, when your family all got together for, like, Christmas and stuff, was there music going on?
There was always going on, yeah. And I'd play with, you know, and my mom and I would play, and there was always, and my sister played guitar and piano, and so we all, there'd be music all around, and my godparents were amazing, and my godmother Jeannie Jennings played violin, mandolin, and my godfather Jim was a flamenco guitarist, and it was wild. I mean, we had a wild time. They'd be bringing flamenco guitarists from Mexico, and all I remember is just music and kind of a lot of tequila and martinis and
cool,
and a lot of joy,
around
the house. My father's also plays. He's very tentative about playing piano, and he knows this one song that he remembers. I don't know how he does it, and he has a really nice voice. So
they still alive, your parents?
Yes.
Wow,
it's amazing.
They still out in Abilene?
85. My mom was 85 on the 9th of February. My dad's 80, turning 87.
Wow.
They're in Abilene.
Yeah. Wow. So when did you? How did you leave Abilene? You went to Juilliard. Did you get accepted to Juilliard? Did you want to get out of Abilene?
Yes, absolutely. We referred to it as the Holy Hump back in the old days.
Why?
But it was kind of a church on every street corner.
Oh, right.
It was
okay.
Pretty hard. I mean, it has a lot, infinitely more flexibility. Gosh, they have their own symphony orchestra, their own art league, their own drama league. I mean, things have changed, but
it's also such a fertile area, like just that West Texas area, like the Terry Allen, Joe
That's
Ely,
right.
Joe Hart, like just that whole group of people that just really a huge art movement.
A lot of
You're close with those guys?
I know Terry Allen, the Allen family, lovely family, and I know Joe. I don't know Joe and as well, but we do know each other peripherally.
They all seem like they had to get out of there, but still kind of they couldn't get it out of them.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that as an artist? Like you might have gotten out of Abilene, but the Abilene's still in you?
Yeah, there's no question about it. And that stuff it's just in your bones and in your blood.
Yeah.
And Butch Hancock also is an amazing visual artist. And Joe, two painters. And Terry, of course, is an installation painter. I just saw an installation of his in New York, which is brilliant. And then played with him at Alejandro Escobedo's, the ACL taping.
Oh, yeah, you played at that.
Yeah, and Terry played too. Amazing.
I think that's how I met you.
Yeah,
was through Alejandro. Yeah, at a thing that you guys played at Waterloo.
That's years right. ago.
I think there's actually a photograph of it.
But yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, Abilene was it served us well. And I had to get out of there and had some problem focusing. And I went to a military school for in Sewanee Military Academy in Tennessee, and still kept the music up. Still kept it was music theory and kept working.
Were
and
you
then,
trouble?
Yeah, it was trouble. I like looking at a box of matches and a can of kerosene. Seems to just kind of make me light up. So, it was a good time.
Yeah.
It was a good time to leave.
So after military school is when you went to Juilliard?
No, that happened. It happened later. It was... I came back and studied at South by Southwest and then went briefly to the University of Texas as well. And then...
you mean Southwest Texas University, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Southwest Texas. Yeah, now Texas University. And then I I really felt, I was playing in a band called Electromagnets with Eric Johnson, and,
yeah.
and we played it, you know, Armadillo, and that was such a wonderful time.
What were you playing in that band?
I was electric, playing a keyboards with Fender Rhodes with stomp boxes and a mini Moog, and I was just, we were incredibly loud. We just cleaned everybody's teeth.
That was a
70s teeth.
Band, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were kind of a rock jazz band as opposed to a jazz rock band because we came from rock and roll roots. And then, I don't know, I just felt I needed more. I wanted to, in the way of arranging and getting to arranging and composing, and then I went to Juilliard and talked to the dean of Juilliard, Gid Waldrop, and he put me with an amazing teacher named John Corleano, who scored the Red Violin and Altered States. This is so awful and so rude.
No.
Laura Scarborough.
Oh, hey.
So that's good.
Yeah, that is good.
But so any rate, and I wanted to study with Luciano Berio, who was kind of one of my idols, and he went to IRCOM in Paris, you know, to work with Boulez over there, and I was kind of heartbroken not to be able to work with him, but I found this amazing, a mentor who changed my life, you know, he was John Corleano, and an amazing composer, and still, he's getting ready to have his 75th anniversary at Carnegie Hall. In fact, I think he's already had it. Well, he has it, I think, on the 15th today or tomorrow.
Wow.
But so that was a whole new frontier that kind of started a new life in New York for me in arranging. And I've been very, very fortunate to work with some great orchestras and really great people.
Well, so once you were up there, what did you start arranging, like on records? Let's go through. You have such an extensive
It's pretty wild.
Discography. It's pretty insane.
Yeah, it started. It really started where I was copying people's music, and this was during the age of when Jaco. Well, that's actually a little bit later when Jaco joined Weather Report. I guess it was around 76, and we used to go to the Brecker Brothers used to have 7th Avenue South, and we would, and all the jazz guys would hang out there, and Gil Evans and his children Miles and Jaco and Mike Brecker and Erskine.
You're talking
and
about like Jaco Pastorius Miles Davis.
Jaco, who played with Weather Report and played with Wayne Crocker.
Yeah.
Amazing. And Joni Mitchell and stuff. He's a monster. Yeah. Stupid. Good. And he was a very close friend. And so I used to go. It was a perfect kind of covey of musicians where I could go in. And so I used to make transcriptions. And I had a good hand for writing music. And so I would make lead sheets and try to, you know, beat the rates of the other ones. And that's how I started supporting. My first apartment was $225 a month.
Where was it?
It was on 71 West 71st Street. And I lived above this cappuccino little family, Italian family store of pastries. And it was John Lennon, Yoko Ono used to go there about 3 times a week. So I would just get my mind obliterated. Walking in, I would look over at the table that was kind of behind the cash register. And there was John Lennon and Yoko Ono there. And, of course, I'd start hearing all those millions of songs in my head and have a nervous breakdown.
Did you ever say anything?
I had one experience with him that I'll never forget. And I was going down with this place where we used to call the Rock. It was very near where Strawberry Fields is now. And if you take Strawberry Fields all the way down and then kind of bank a left-hand
Central Park. Yeah.
Central Park by the past Strawberry Fields, kind of at the statue of Daniel Webster, and then hang a left and bank around the reservoir. There is this little gazebo out there. And I remember seeing just kind of ambushing. I think I was more ambushed than he was, and it was John Lennon with Sean, and he was just kind of dangling his feet at the side of the reservoir, and I went up to him. I was completely ready to supernova in Central Park, and I looked at him and said, "I am so sorry." I said, "You guys have a great day," and there was this pregnant pause, and he looked right directly at me, and he goes, "And yourself?" I said, "John Lennon just spoke to me."
Yeah, that's too heavy.
This is where I can throw myself under a car and feel good about it.
So, Stephen, man, this is interesting because you wear a lot of hats. You're a jazz guy, a rock guy, and a classical guy.
Yeah.
That's three different kinds of guys.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if you asked, like, Sarah from Tosca to jazz out, she couldn't... I mean, to my knowledge, she could not jazz out. I cannot classical out or jazz out. I can only rock out. Like,
There were two main mentors in my life that I was very close with. One was obviously John Corleone, who I previously mentioned.
Right.
And another was a gentleman by the name of Joseph Zawinul, who wrote for Miles Davis. He was classically trained in Austria, and he came from Austria to America in the late 50s and ended up playing with Dinah Washington. He wrote 40 songs for Cannonball Adderley, including Mercy, Mercy, Mercy.
Wow.
And Birdland with Weather Report. And he kind of expanded. He was one of those guys who was a real, what they call, world musician before they had a label for it. And he was the one that turned me on to Eastern European music, to Egyptian music. And I was in the No Theater in Japan and the Gagaku orchestras and Balinese orchestras, and there was this big, where the aperture really opened up for me musically from the classical world, kind of extended into all that, and that's where I got interested in multinational dialects. So I've studied that stuff and on my own, not like in a school, but, you know, I can write in those styles, you know, and it's just been a long journey. It's a few years down the road, but I enjoy it.
I mean, but wasn't it, like the mindset of like a classical person is to study and study and study. And then in a jazz world, if I'm not wrong, is kind of to study and then forget everything you learned, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then go back to it. And then in rock and roll, it just doesn't really matter. You know, as long as you can make something and express yourself, you're cool. Is this what, it's just...
Well, things happen with education in classical music. In classical music in the old days, I mean, people improvised. And somehow in the classical, in the academe, that seemed to collapse. I think maybe organ, you know, still teaches one how to improvise. I mean, there are schools like Berkeley and stuff, and jazz kind of, you know, have that kind of more progressive attitude of teaching.
But in classical music, there's not an improvisational. No. Now there's not.
No, not really. I mean, the piano and classical, you know, as a classical or piano, going into applied piano, they don't teach you how to read or improvise in a very where there becomes an ease in figured bass, and that's what all those guys used to do. And Bach was an incredible improviser. So was Beethoven. So was Mozart. So was Brahms. There's still piano rolls where you can hear Brahms and Debussy. All those guys. And Messiaen, all those guys,
improvised.
You know, improvised. Yeah. And I mean, with total ease, like a jazz musician.
Right.
And somehow that's all kind of fallen in on itself. It would be as if all the charts from jazz music, say from Charlie Parker, and it would be like 100 years from now that's all written out, and there's no kind of... part of it,
even though they were doing that just in the moment and improvising, this is what you've learned as the melody and
where it becomes
charted out.
Classical music and hardwired on a page. You know,
it's so strange, isn't it?
It is very strange. And I wonder, I wonder if that's just kind of the security, there's some kind of security to be able to keep it pure or be able to keep it, but it's always going to change.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the beauty of it to me.
Yeah.
It's a changing of it, but...
So let's go back to New York. You're there. You're doing you're writing arrangements and stuff, mm-hmm. and kind of being the guy with the lowest price.
yeah. And then I ended up going in.
What year was that kind of like the heyday, like 77, 78, when things were like crazy there?
Yeah,
the blackout.
Back when I took a gun to CBGB's.
Really?
I had a 32 coat until the Giuliani passed the handgun law.
Well, you kind of had to.
Yeah, you did. Oh, it was super dangerous.
Because it was a dangerous town.
It was very dangerous. And
you stick a kid in West Texas over there.
That's right.
And yeah.
It was so... I mean, it was just monkey see, monkey do, and everybody, you know, had guns and drugs over there. So, it was crazy. And to show you how naive it was back then, you know, I ended up sending it back on the bus, on the Greyhound bus to Austin. I mean, that's, you know, and I mean, people did that all the time. It was, you know, it was crazy back then and so naive. And of course, when 9/11 went down, everything just, of course, went topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
And rightly so, you know, with security. But anyway, it was a real Wild West.
So in the 70s there, you were going to CBGBs? Were you going to Max's?
Yeah, going to Max's, Kansas City, sure. Trax. You know, Trax is like, saw the expensive winos and Keith Richards playing over there. I mean, it was wild, you know. And then, of course, with the...
And you worked with him, right? Didn't you work
with Keith? Yeah, I had the opportunity to work with Keith Richards. I certainly did. I'm very, very lucky.
How was that? What was that like?
It was an amazing experience.
Yeah?
He was very gracious host. And we would, would work in his basement. You know, and his place.
That's cool as shit.
Yeah, and he was just, I mean, I just had to pinch myself just sitting, you know, where he would be sitting on the piano stool and I'd be playing, he'd be playing guitar and sitting on the piano bench. And I mean, I just had to look around. It was kind of like the acid flashback that, you know, I was promised.
But a guy like that, when you're working with him, man, I mean, like, you were around Miles Davis. Around, you know, a lot of these guys,
Amazing people.
They aware of the weight that they carry?
Yeah, I mean,
but they're cool. Some people can be really gracious with that.
Yeah.
You know?
I never really got to work with Miles Davis, per se. I got to hear him play. But, I mean, yeah, there's a whole different ball of, you know, whole different kinds of frequency that you know, you feel like you're just, you know, being microwaved, but they are human beings. And a lot of them really kind of stripped down and having the opportunity to meet all different kinds of people in New York from all, you know, from Edward Albee to, you know, to Keith Richards to, you know, guys from Monty Python. I mean, it's like they all carry this certain, there's something that definitely connects them to the human existence, and that's why they exist
the picture,
and where they hang, because they do understand how nature and how human beings work. They're very hyper-human, you know, if you will. And, you know, we have them here in Austin. I mean, God, all around us. I mean, you know, Willie Nelson, for God's sakes, and, I mean, Rupert Neve, and, I mean, in all kinds of different facets. And,
right.
Yeah, they belong to the world. They are those people that belong.
Yeah.
They're bigger than life, and they belong to the world. We need them.
So, yeah. So in the late 70s, you were arranging, and you were doing that kind of stuff. Is that when you met David Byrne?
I was playing with Christopher Cross at that time, too. And Christopher was a really good friend. That was another musical family, wonderful musical family.
Tell me about that. When did you, what was, is that the sailing era? Like the big record?
Yes, it was. And it was an amazing period in my life. And, you know, of course, Chris was, you know, he was, you know, with Warner Brothers at that time and just, you know, kind of had the world on a string after his successes with that first
Did you
record.
Work on that record?
I did not work on the record.
No.
It was with Michael O'Mardian.
Right.
He was an amazing pianist in between he and Rob Muir, you know, who's been with Chris since the get-go. Yeah, he's the pianist that played with Chris and a really wonderful player and arranger on his own, and so they worked on that record. I was mostly the touring guy, and then
the touring piano player,
with Rob and taking those arrangements and condensing them down to synthesizers and stuff.
Oh, okay,
taking Michael's scores and various Omardian scores.
Well, that's interesting because what was that, like 1980? What did you use, like an ARP
or
something?
Well, we had,
because there's no samples.
We had Roland's, had like a Juno, and had an OBXA, you know, the Oberheims, and Fender Rhodes and acoustic piano. We carried acoustic piano with us at that time, which was great because it really filled out the band. So
you had the money to take. I mean, just taking a Rhodes like with a band in a van with a U-Haul, that's ridiculous. I even got that smaller one to do that, but I got tired of that too. It's fucking heavy.
Yeah, they're real heavy.
So how long did you do that? Because you have toured extensively. I mean, that was a pretty big tour.
Oh, yeah, went all over the place. We went to South Africa back during apartheid when we were one of those bands.
Yeah, yeah.
An amazing time. Over the world, Asia.
I remember seeing Christopher Cross and remembering, and this isn't any slight in any way, that he looked very different than I thought he would. But I think it was Midnight Special. Did you do that with them? Or like one of those kind
of
shows?
I did one of them. I think actually Hank Hemsoth was the previous keyboard player.
Okay.
Played keyboard and sax. And I think that he did the Midnight Special with Chris. He was like one of the first tours with them.
Right. So how long, what did you do after the Christopher Cross thing?
I worked from 83 to 80. Really, I think our last trip to Japan was around 86-87, but during that whole time I was composing music in New York. I was working for a Fairy Tale Theater, which was a thing Shelley Duvall did for Showtime.
Yeah.
And I was I wrote 13 of those, I was under the director of Van Dyke Parks, who was also a huge inspiration. I just heard from Van Dyke 2 days ago.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. He was a huge mentor as well.
So, are you, is this the kind of, this is the kind of guy that this is the kind of career that you have, the same kind of job as a Van Dyke Parks?
Yeah, I mean,
you cruise around, you sprinkle your magic on people.
I try to do that. Van Dyke certainly does that. I mean, he's been all over creation, from U2, of course, to the Beach, the brilliant stuff with the Beach Boys, to Here and Far, and I mean, he's all over the place. And
some beautiful stuff he did with Rufus Wainwright, too.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of people don't realize he was the first producer for Lil George, for Harry Nilsson.
Right, I knew about the Harry Nilsson. I didn't know about Lil George.
And Randy Newman produced his first record.
Wow!
And I remember we used to play these parties. And one time I was, "Come on, we gotta go to this party and play." They always want me to play piano, so we go in. It was Shelley Duvall and my friend Stanley Wilson, and Van Dyke was there, and we played for Angelica Houston's party with every star you could possibly,
so cool.
With every possible Hollywood star you could imagine.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I'm playing piano and who walks up but Harry Nilsson, and he goes, let's play some blues or something. You know, you gotta know a shuffle or something. I go, hey, cool, let's go. Yeah. And so all of a sudden he just started making up, you know, these verses, and there it is, Harry Nilsson right in my face, singing his ass off.
Jesus.
It was insane. It was just absolutely...
That was a great show, Fairy Tale Theater.
Yeah, we had a great time.
Yeah, and so when you were composing, were you commissioned? Yeah, for different things. And then after the Christopher Cross, then what did you do?
Well, I was doing that, all during that time. And after Christopher Cross, I just kept going and working and, of course, continuing my writing.
Did you like that
writing.
Better than being out on the road?
I tend to like the studio
as
a rule much better if I had to, actually pick one or the other. I really loved, really loved the studio and the alchemy you can build there. And that came a lot with the arranging, of course, and then ended up working, of course, eventually meeting David Byrne later down the line and a number of people, and Craig Street, who was a really great producer, got me working. He produced Joe Henry and, of course, got to work with Ornette Coleman.
Tell me about what records did you do with David Byrne?
Oh, gosh. Growing Backwards is one, but mainly was his live stuff. And I think I've arranged like 30 pieces for back. Special and Tosca was playing in the
band.
Of course, it's similar to what he is doing now with the horn stuff, you know, with the St. Vincent's tour and mm-hmm. this gigantic horn stuff, which I didn't work on that particular project, but
the thing you did with St. Vincent,
yeah,
it's an awesome album,
brilliant,
yeah.
And but Growing Backwards is one that just comes to mind, and we had a we've had a really great friendship, and of course he and his relationship with Terry Allen goes long way back stories to the movie and even before. They're a very close family, and close with each other, and
yeah.
I mean, David is a very, very fascinating human being. I mean, his output is completely paranormal.
He's one of the cool, like, intellectual, highbrow rock and roll guys. There's not a lot of those guys.
And still can...
But without being like Lou Reed, without having to, you know, slum in the gutter, he's still got that, you know.
In the books, in the installations,
yeah.
And it's just like, man, you know, it's... And he was really... there was a reawakening there, and just watching through kind of that really wide swath. And, I've really enjoyed working, you know, doing installation work as well, and playing and getting into kind of the art community has been really fruitful, and working with Arto Lindsay, and we've done some solo performances. We did one at the Art Basel at the Beiler Museum, of course, in Basel, which is one of the top galleries. And now I'm working with this artist, Rafael Vargas Suarez, who's a wonderful artist, painter, and we're doing an installation for the Volta Gallery in New York for March.
Well, you're composing music for?
Sound design.
Wow.
Yeah, we have sound designs from... Working with it's based on supersonics and subsonic frequencies. So we have designs from subsonic frequencies produced by whales and elephants to having actual audios that are attached that are from rocket boosters. You know, from like the space shuttle.
Right. Right.
Kind of whizzing down at the atmosphere at 2,500 miles an hour. You know, these big nine-story rocket boosters.
Wow.
And they're open on one end, right? But they're out of fuel. And so they're just like a Coke bottle whizzing.
Right.
And, of course, they put microphones and cameras on all those things at NASA so you can actually watch them come in. They hit the water at 200 miles an hour when they hit the ocean. They're nine stories.
Do you go to NASA to get this stuff?
No.
It's just public domain?
It's public domain, yeah. And of course, Rafael, you know, his background is in astrophysics and astronomy. So he's funneled us into what he's looking at to try to bring all this to fruition in the sound design. So we're using woodwinds from Bob Malik, a brilliant woodwind virtuoso, and stacking electronica. And I'm working on that with Andres Levine, you know, who's really one of the top Latin producers who produce Yerba Buena and Cucu de Mandes to Miguel Bosé to Caetano Veloso. I mean, he's all over the map in Latin scene. So we're busy.
That's awesome. Do you speak Spanish? A little bit.
Enough to get myself in and out of jail, I think. I could get me.
That's good. So, say, like in the early 90s, is that when you worked with Keith Richards, or mid 90s?
It was toward the mid to late 90s. It was like around Bridges of Babylon days. And I met Keith through engineer Goathead Soup, Rob Fraboni. And through Blondie Chaplin, who's one of my closest friends for, gosh, over 20 years now, who's one of the background singers with Rolling Stones. He's been there. He didn't do this particular tour that they did in London, New York, but he's been with them for, 15 years.
Wow. How did you meet Alejandro?
Oh,
you guys are very close friends.
We are. We certainly are. I met Alejandro, I think. I came back to Austin in 2000. I've been in New York since 77, top of 77.
Right.
And Alejandro and I met just through the the world of Swirl in Austin, and I mean he was one of the great songwriters, and that's what I was interested in, kind of coming back into Austin again. And I was like, you know, what's rumbling around Austin? I said, right. Man, you got to hear this guy Alejandro Escovedo. He's going to blow your mind, you know. And I went to one of his gigs, and I just went, man, this is like an open furnace. I want to work with this guy.
Yeah.
And so that kind of pooled us together and met each other through Stephen Bruton, and it was through...
And you worked with Stephen a lot, too.
Yeah, Stephen was a dear friend. I certainly did. Worked on his records, and this was when Stephen was producing Alejandro.
Right.
With These Hands and kind of during that era, and that's when I met Alejandro. Was through Stephen.
Tell me about Stephen. How did you meet him? Did you meet him through T-Bone or what was the...
Oh, it was wild. I knew about Stephen long after he left Fort Worth. He was, we had heard about him as young kids in Abilene, like we heard about Jimmy Vaughn. I saw Jimmy Vaughn when he was 15 years old with the Chessmen. I was 14. And it was kind of like Stephen. He had already, all that was kind of drifting back and forth of all the kind of the hot musicians coming from Dallas and Fort Worth. And Stephen was actually, and a lot of people don't realize, was a banjo prodigy. He was one of the top bluegrass banjo players in that entire area and won all these competitions, and his brother Sumter. But at any rate, I didn't really meet Stephen until much later, although I heard about him. I didn't meet Stephen until the late 80s.
Okay. And what was he doing then?
Face to face.
Well, he was doing Bonnie Raitt stuff.
He was doing with Bonnie, and you know, of course, he had been with Kris Kristofferson forever, off and on.
Yeah.
Since he was 17 years old. I mean, he had been playing with Chris since he was a young kid, and so we met, and I mean, of course, it was like we'd known each other since we were kids. Really, we were very, very close.
Yeah.
And so.
What a gracious guy. I would love to find try and put together a show about him, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be good just to, you know, one of these, you know, with kind of a group of people that could kind of describe. Because there was something amazing about him. He was always, you know, he was a guy that always made you feel like he was excited to see you as opposed, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even for someone like me, you know, a little bit younger. Like, oh, you're Stephen Bruton. He'd be like, hey, Johnny, how's it going with such and such? And he always knew and stuff. It was so nice.
Yeah, he was a real minister as well to helping. He was the first guy there. You know, when someone was in trouble, and, of course, worked a lot in NA and AA as well and saved a lot of people's lives. My favorite story about, I think, what sums up Stephen Bruton is, a while back, Bonnie Raitt had a stalker, and I think it, you know, had been in the paper, but it was something that got everyone's attention. And you know, a lot of times musicians, when they're in their hotel room, have their own nom de plume, whatever, like Noah Vale. Was Stephen Bruton's nom de plume in the hotel was Bonnie Raitt, because he wanted to get his hands on this guy and throw him out the window. So.
Yeah.
When he was on tour, I used to call him up, call the hotel, and I'd say, Bonnie Raitt, please. I'd hear the phone pick up, and it'd be, hello. Bruton, what are you doing? That's your man.
Yeah. So who else have you toured with?
Oh, wow.
Like, toured?
As far as touring.
Yeah, just touring.
Touring, well, I guess Eric Johnson I've
How
toured
was that?
With.
It you, was guys, great. You guys must be pretty good friends. You've
We're
been
very
still
close,
close
friends. Yeah, he's busy as can be.
What's he doing now?
Well, he's working on, I think, a new record.
Yeah.
We're getting ready to go in and do a record, and he's been busy with has this amazing studio. He's been busy with a whole guitar line, you know, and signature guitar line
with
Gibson and with Martin and other people, and he's... Seems like he's ginning along, but I know he's really been putting a lot of work into his studio and getting the control room.
It's interesting when you're a guy like that, you know, and you're about to come out with an album in 2013, and you're kind of like an innovator on an instrument. What do you do? You know what I mean?
And he's, you know, he's an innovator, you know, and that really kind of extends into the whole audiophile, and
right.
and he knows what he wants. And so it kind of extends into the, you know, from having his particular design and pickups to grounding the studio where the electricity is clean and going. I mean, it's constant.
He's got a pretty fine ear, apparently.
Yeah, he really does. And he knows what he wants, and so it goes under a lot of scrutiny.
Do you have a pretty fine ear? Do you have I can tell the difference between vinyl and MP3?
Oh,
and
yeah. I think it's just working with it for a long time and working with it consistently in the studio. And
yeah
I'm a big vinyl enthusiast.
Yeah.
And
Eric Johnson must be a pretty mellow guy on the road. It's probably different than touring with Keith Richards.
Yeah.
Even though you didn't tour with Keith Richards, I can just imagine.
Gosh, I would have loved to tour with Keith Richards. But Eric is just, I mean, it's just all about maintenance. You know, it's family. It's like going on the road. And in a way, it's kind of like, you know, you have the, like being on a ship and the, sometimes the water's on fire and sometimes it isn't, you know, sometimes it's even keel. And sometimes, you know, it's like family in a way. It has that algorithms of that. And I think, but I have so much respect that people that do, you know, have that road element in them and have that discipline, because it's a discipline to be able to do it. But my discipline's pretty much in the studio.
Yeah.
That's where I live.
And, yeah.
But it's been...
I want to go through your discography and just kind of grab some stuff. And I will say this. You are the very first person, I'm pretty sure, in the 150-something episodes that I've recorded so far that is credited with playing the lute on an album.
Yeah, I've worked with... You know, I played all sorts of wild stuff.
Yeah. So you've done stuff with John Legend?
Yes.
You did some string arrangements?
Yeah, and
how was that? That
was with Kanye West this particular one Craig Street produced, but yeah, it was between Craig and
did
Kanye
you meet
West.
Kanye?
Yeah, I've met him. He's a very nice man. Very nice.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I'm a huge Kanye fan.
Yeah. Yeah, he's
I bet he's a very nice man.
Chicago.
Very smart.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, a lot of times, you know, people, he's a performer, he's flamboyant, and I've heard all these stories, but, you know, it's like he knows, I mean, I love his records, and he knows
me
what
too.
He wants, and John, too. I mean, John's very, very well raised. He's a gentleman, and I mean, I had nothing but great times.
I always thought it was a really interesting choice of Kanye at one point to literally sort of like, do a 180 and go do a record produced by John Bryan, which I thought was just really
brilliant. He's one of my favorite arrangers.
Yeah.
Arrangers.
Do you know him?
I do not know him, but I'm certainly a huge fan of his,
yeah.
Like Van Dyke, and same with David Campbell, you know, who does Beck's father. So he does all the strings and stuff for Beck, which are incredibly innovative. And he's a good friend, David.
Wow.
But I'd like to meet, Byron. He's just, I've heard is wonderful.
It's fantastic. A guest that's been on the show, Amy Cook. She's fantastic.
Amy Cook's great.
Big strings. On that,
yeah,
I did arranging.
Screen someone for a records, not the last one, but the one before last.
The one that you guys did at Boyle's studio,
correct.
On Mutual Friend,
yeah.
Which we have a lot of mutual, and of course, work with McLaughlin.
Yeah, I love him. We just finished his last record, and I was such a massive. That's kind of like working with a Beatle to me, because the Small Faces were equally my favorite band back in the age when the Beatles were together, and with Stevie Marriott and Ronnie Lane, of course, and Mac at the wheel. And I mean, working with him was kind of like working with Keith, working with all those guys.
Yeah.
I was equally as starstruck with, you know, with him as any of the other famous people I've worked with. I mean, I just remember wearing those records out.
Yeah.
You know, Ichiku Park and Have You Ever Seen Me? And I mean, it was just insane.
Well, it's interesting because you have that same thing that he does, where it's like it doesn't really matter the size of the venue or the weight of the gig publicly. Like For instance, I saw him on HBO on the Hall of Fame thing. And I went and saw him for free at Lucky Lounge at happy hour. You know what I mean? Thursday following that. And it's the same guy. I say this a lot on this podcast, but you know what? I believe probably it should be the main message that you're doing it because you love playing. He loves playing, and it's the same for him with Ronnie and Kenny at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as it is with Scrappy, you know.
Absolutely.
And God knows who else at the Lucky Lounge. He's still that same guy. You have that as well.
It's making music.
Yeah, you're just
absolutely
making music. We're all happy to be there.
Or like, you know, the Beatles. I mean, you know, for their performance, they could have picked anywhere. And where did they do it? On the roof of Apple Corp.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
Yeah.
It tells you kind of where that resonates.
And, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about the live music. I personally love playing, you know, playing clubs.
Yeah.
And when I do play.
How about Natalie Merchant?
We just finished Natalie's new record in December, the 1st of December. And it's a beautiful record. She's amazing. I mean, she manages to just find her way with it. And literally, and in this time in music where people often don't know kind of where to market their stuff, the record before this new one that's going to be coming out, we did 26 tracks where she set music to different poems from Thomas Louis Stevenson to E.E. Cummings to, you know, Timbuktu. I mean, they were all over the place. And she ended up selling them to libraries and schools. And, I mean, she...
Smart person.
Very smart. And also very nurturing, you know.
Yeah.
She is motherland, you know.
Yeah.
And a great mom. And she's about making music to nurture people. And I just thought this idea of her setting all those poems was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And no one's really, you know, I guess they did the Dylan Thomas, you know, George Martin did the Dylan Thomas stuff and had and set all those songs, you know, with Elton John and musicians. But yeah, I mean, Natalie's very forward.
It's not like the biggest selling thing on iTunes right now,
right,
or anything.
Right.
It's cool to at least be able. Now you did a record with poems with Kim Kristoff.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, we just finished setting that, and Alejandra actually introduced me to Kim and her poetry, and I became a big fan, and so we decided to take 7 songs and set them. I set them to piano and coloratura. I wanted the voice to be a little bit more expansive, and so we got Carla McElhaney with Revel, a chamber music group here in Austin, and then Carr Johnston Firestone, who's a coloratura and sings with Houston Opera and with Austin Lyric Opera. And so I wanted something that was a little more operatic only because of the range, so... And the range of the poetry, I thought, would make a good balance. So
yeah,
did it.
There was a song on iTunes as I was looking for some stuff of yours that's on a record. It's pretty recent. You had it on your website. It's Red. I can't remember the name, but you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Astro Vinyl.
What was that?
It was a record that I did for the Parma Records. It's Navona Records. They're a classical record, and so we worked together on that particular.
And what was your role in that?
I wrote the music.
For all of it?
For all of it, yeah.
Okay.
So it's all chamber music, large and small chamber music. And then there's some stuff for soprano. My friend Lucy Schaefer.
Yeah, I heard a piece of that.
She's amazing. And she lives in England and getting ready to come out with her own record on ABC Records. And worked on that in England as well and went over and co-produced that record. And so... Yeah, we're just moving along,
yeah,
trying
you
to
really
push
are,
the
man.
Air around, you know?
So
life is short.
I'm just going to read some names off, but then I'm going to ask you some specific things. You've worked with Jennifer Warnes.
Yes, brilliant.
Eric Johnson, we already talked about that. Chris Whitley, Natalie Merchant, Arturo Lindsay, David Byrne, Loudon Wainwright III, Joe Satriani. Tell me about Trixie Whitley.
Trixie's got a new record out that hit number one on the iTunes.
Yeah? Yeah. There you go.
That's Chris's daughter. And
okay.
She and Thomas Bartlett, who had The National, a really great band.
Yeah, that was a great band.
Yeah, and Thomas produced it with Trixie. And actually, he produced it. And Pat Dillett had his hand in it, who's an engineer and producer. He's produced David Byrne and Ardo and a lot of stuff. Brilliant engineer. And Mary J. Blige. And yeah, he's all over the map, too. And they went and made an astonishing record. And it just came out literally in the last few weeks, like last 3-4 weeks.
And you did this
that much.
String
and I did two string arrangements on it. And then and Tom, it's essentially just a few, very, very few people just pitching in. And, you know, Trixie's a great drummer, great piano player, guitar player. Thomas played keyboard, bass, and bass pedals, and played all the piano stuff, which is, he's one of my new favorite piano players. Not new, I mean, I've always been a fan of his. And there's a few, Rob Moose, played the strings, and we just stacked strings on, but it's definitely a record that you should have in your pocket. Yeah, just incredible. And her, she reminds me so much of, you know, Chris was one of my best friends, and that was during the Jeff Buckley days in the West Village, and had
a great
time.
Buckley as well?
I knew Buckley, but I can't say I was a closer friend with Chris, but I did know Jeff Buckley, yeah, and he was an amazing talent, and had friends who worked with him. He was just, gosh, his brain was just, I mean, like a sponge. And like, yeah, I had a friend, you know, Amit Chatterjee, and he spent like a, you know, an afternoon with Amit, great sitarist, incredible Indian vocalist, and studied, was his first instrument when he lived in India, in Calcutta. And he said one day with Jeff Buckley, when he went to hear him sing and play, he said he had consumed in that one day the knowledge and the acumen that most people would have taken at least 5 or 6 years in one afternoon. I mean, he's just had that ear and that capacity.
Yeah. Seems like that. And Chris Whitley as well, huh?
Chris
real
as
magical
well.
Artist.
Yeah, real magical, real
sad
inventive.
Losses.
Yeah, that was a hard hit losing him. But we have Chris, and I've known Trixie since she was 3, and she called me Cowboy Steve. And so she lists me on the record as Cowboy Steve, which
that's
is
fantastic.
Really sweet. But there are similarities, certainly, and through being with her father in the summers in New York. But on the other hand, there are things about her that, I mean, Chris would have been so proud. I mean, that are kind of lit unto her own and a million miles away from what
how great
Chris's
that she still
choices.
Gets Cowboy Steve to come.
Yeah, isn't that hilarious?
Stuff. That's,
yeah,
that's
I'm
just...
I'm one of the old guys on the record. She invited the... the guys from the Dead Pecker Bench to be on her be on her label.
The Dead Pecker Bench. I'm really glad we got I've always loved running into you and talking to you, and you've
too.
Always been so nice and so gracious and just a great hang.
I enjoyed your music too.
Thank you very much. That means a lot coming from you.
Yeah.
So what's next? You finish this stuff with Carl and
I finish up with Carl.
You're
finish
up in New York
this,
here.
Mm-hmm. Finish the installation, and now I'm finishing a commission based. They wanted me to write a book on a piece based on the Fountainhead, the book, the Ayn Rand book, and Ayn Rand. I don't particularly like the book, but it's a I like to try to change the name to Taliesin or something, you know, which was kind of where she was hanging out and watching Frank Lloyd Wright run around. But anyway, working on that and finishing the fountain, this piece, the Fountainhead, this seven-piece chamber group. And then I'm really barreling in. I want to try to, I'm working on a ballet that I'm going to try to take somewhere that I like to talk about it, but I don't want to jinx it. But I've been going a lot to New York City Ballet and studying, especially the collaborations between Stravinsky and Balanchine. And so I found a book, and I'm going to start working on a ballet, first one.
Wow.
So that's going to be a labor of love in probably about a year with a pencil in my hand, but I'm determined to do it and then find a choreographer and see where
when you sit down
can
and
live.
When you sit down and compose, you sit at a piano?
I sit at a piano with pencil and paper. I still do it the old-fashioned way.
You just write down the music. Say you get an idea, you're on a plane. Can you just write it down?
I carry music with me on the plane, yeah, and I write it down. Mm-hmm. I have a little tiny piece of paper, looks about the size of a small pocket calendar that you can flip it up and it has music in there.
Yeah.
And sometimes it'll happen.
And people can just find out your whole thing. You've got a great website, StephenBarber.com, right?
I do. And okay. I post like 12 tracks generally every.
Yeah.
I wanted to try to do it four times a year generally or every month, which is ran out of material
ambitious.
Quickly.
Yeah.
But I'll post some things up there. And
you've got a studio here?
I have a little studio with a piano and some people called Alejandro called it the deer blind. you have to have diphtheria and typhoid and polio vaccines before you can even attempt to set a foot in that place. It's pretty vicious.
Is it in a swamp or something here?
It's in a little tiny efficiency apartment place. We have probably more animals than they do at the Science and Nature Center in Austin in our apartment. So
right on. Well, people can find out find you at StephenBarber.com.
Correct.
And
yeah.
And is there anything I'm leaving out?
No, man, we're pretty much on track. There are a lot of names and
a lot of
years at it. But yeah. I guess I just feel real lucky to still be able to do this stuff.
Yeah.
And looking forward to writing more stuff in the here and now and discovering more stuff as well. So
thanks for coming on the
show.
Thank
you, Johnny, man.
And enriching it, taking it out of the dick joke land into a little higher brow. Thanks, Stephen.
We're working on it.
Thank you, man.
Bye bye. Thank you.
Man, it's still hard for me to believe that people come to my apartment that are that cool and just hang out and talk to me. A lot of people come over here. Oh, Stephen Barber, man, what a great guy. Great musician. What a talent. Great gift to music and art, the world. Great gift to the world. All right. Check out Stephen's stuff. Get out there. Look at this stuff. I'll play you a song right now that he did with David Byrne. You'll like it. And don't forget, get out there. Get on iTunes. Subscribe. Rate us. Comment. It really helps. We're reaching out, starting to try to get a little advertising. Oh, and good news. Maybe I shouldn't share the news yet. I'm about to leave to go out and see this band that's here from New York and interview them out at this compound. They're here writing songs for a month. So I'm going to go do that. I'm going to leave you with a little more Stephen Barber and David Byrne. And I want you to have a great day. Please, seriously, have a great day. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Ausência. Se asa um te ver pra voar na existência, se gazelle fosse pra correr sem num cancera, então já não você entrava na manchê, nunca mais a ausência tá se nos lembra, mas só na pensamento. Semana agnasso mi fuoce un tempo protesta un tenso bo carino e bo sorriso ai solida ten sina sono sina sel so te bria ma stessa canna se clara sabe pra onde ele me apra onde vai ai solidão ensina ai solidão te sina sono sina céu sou te bria mas te seca na seclara sem sabe pra onde ele me apra onde vai ai solidão. Ausência, ausência.